The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is a great way to stay on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day with a free email newsletter, a handy smartphone app, and of course at our newly revamped website at subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in the DC suburbs of Northern Virginia today for a conversation with Dave Rank, who until quite recently was chargé d'affaires of the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. As many of you probably know, Dave resigned his position after President Trump announced that he would be withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, making the U.S. one of three countries in the world, along with Syria and Nicaragua, that will not be part of the Paris Agreement. And Nicaragua, as you've probably already heard, only refused to sign because the agreement didn't do enough. So Dave, thanks so much for inviting me to your home and agreeing to talk about your decision.
Kaiser, it's great to be here, and welcome back to my home. The last time we got together, I think
you were
in my home, my apartment in Beijing.
I mean, how did you manage to get the stuff over so quickly? How does that work? Because I see some Chinese stuff here.
Right. You saw earlier when you were coming in, the renter who had, we had left the place empty, or not empty, left it full because we have a couple of kids or had a couple of kids in college at the time, so we rented the place out to the music director from our church, and with the understanding that the room became the whole house until the kids came back for the weekend, that sort of thing. Or I blew up my career and
You had to blow up the career clause in there already. Right. good thinking. So you are an admirably nonpartisan guy. It's a rare thing these days, and I respect that. But I am a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, and I have made no secret of my feelings about the man now in the Oval Office. So I have to applaud you, but get that right out of the way. I want to start by trying to get a sense of your inner dialogue and perhaps the conversations that you had with your wife, Mary, your family members, and with your faith that led you to this decision. Get inside your head and tell me what was going on.
Yeah, I have to say, talking to, you know, I've never seen myself as a climate guy per se, and it seemed implausible from the outset that we would pull out. And I mean, not from a American partisan political perspective, but just from the perspective of what made sense from foreign policy, what made sense from the point of American leadership. So it didn't occur to me. I mean, the idea that we might stay in but downgrade our ambition, the sorts of commitments that we intended to carry through in Paris, that seemed sort of the likely, pretty unpalatable outcome, but the kind of thing that diplomats are used to doing, you know, working with not great scenarios and trying to salvage what we could out of it. You know, it only hit me really about a day beforehand. It struck me, wow, we could really pull out. You know, the reports coming out of Washington were that we might entirely pull out. And I have to say at that point, I mean, it left a pit in my stomach. And as you probably saw in the reporting of my departure, you know, both from not just from a foreign policy perspective, but really from a moral perspective, from the perspective of a father of three kids, just couldn't do it.
When you heard the news, you had already made up your mind, presumably by then. How long did it take you between hearing the news and actually deciding that you were going to pull the trigger?
Well, it was the complication of my wife was back on the family farm, her family farm in rural Illinois, and so we had to. I mean, that's kind of a decision. It was hard to take.
Right on your own.
Solo. So we did I sent some talking points to her, as we are wont to do in my business, and said, are you good with these? Essentially, laying down, you know, not the idea of resigning, but that I just couldn't have anything to do with the implementation of the agreement.
Right. Which you couldn't actually deliver to the Marshall.
Well, I mean, there's a little garble on what specifically the request was, but it was, I freely admit, a very minor request of me, You know, I was not asked to go to Paris to, you know, break into the vault holding the agreement and tear it up. You know, that it was a symbolic act that I was asked to do, and I just decided I couldn't do it.
So for me, Trump's decision to pull out of Paris came piled atop other outrages, especially the ones during his at that point, very recent overseas trip, his first overseas trip, especially in his meetings with NATO. I mean, his refusal to make mention of Article 5, and then the shoving of the Montenegrin prime minister for that photo op, and a lot of other things that he did. And this, I mean, not to mention the myriad other things that he's done to damage the American reputation abroad, and the border wall, the travel ban, and much more. I can't imagine how difficult it must have been for you as a career diplomat, or others like you, to just watch your work just being sort of casually shattered the way Trump had done. Was this a cumulative thing for you, or would the pullout from Paris, had it happened in hypothetical isolation, would that have been enough to prompt your resignation?
You know, it's the alternative reality, or, you know, the other paths the U.S. might have gone down. I don't know. I mean, it's clearly everything is cumulative in a person's experience.
That's right.
It certainly didn't make it easy. And you can't just pin it on this administration. I mean, I was really dismayed by the decision to pull out of TPP.
Sure.
But that's a cross-administration thing. I was dismayed with the lack of enthusiasm that the previous administration put into passing TPP. Essentially, it seemed like the plan to pass it depended on a Hillary Clinton victory and running it through the lame duck Congress, which seemed to be, for something that important to our position in this part of the world, a pretty thin strategy to hang it on. So I won't say it was, you know, my concern about the American commitment to U.S. leadership in the world is just a function of the Donald Trump administration. But you're right. I mean, there's some things, not just in Asia, but worldwide, that this administration has taken that I think dismays a lot of people who see the practical benefits to American leadership.
Right. Again, the work that you guys had done, I mean, it's like watching one of your children marched off to be shot. I mean, it was terrible. Anyway, so where were you actually when you heard that President Trump had made the decision to pull out when he made the Rose Garden speech?
I want to say I was traveling somewhere in China.
Okay.
And I got back and had sort of caught myself, was catching up on the news overnight. And like I say, when it hit me that, wow, I think we're going to pull out. And of course, by the time what time was the Rose Garden speech?
It was like 2 p.m. or 3
right,
p.m.
So that would have been middle of the night.
Yeah, middle of the night, right.
In Beijing. So I was, as my family will tell you, if it's after 9:30, I was sound asleep. But by the time the actual decision had been made, I think it was pretty clear what was going to happen. If you read Axios or the other press channels, it was clear that he was going to pull out.
Would you have, you said you wouldn't describe yourself as some sort of committed and active environmentalist. You know, you weren't a climate guy. You weren't somebody who had really boned up on all the climate science. But clearly, you had pretty strong feelings about this. How did global warming rank among the different issues that were of concern for you? And how important do you think it was for American moral leadership in the world?
Right. American leadership. I hate to characterize countries as having a moral role, although certainly we have, I think that has been one of the advantages, or one of the messages and one of the strengths of the United States is the ability, not just on things like climate, but also human rights, where we have taken clear moral stands. Before heading out to Beijing, before taking the job as the number two, and then ultimately at the change of administration, I was temporarily head of the U.S. mission in China. One of the reasons I decided to take the job is understanding that I'm not an expert or not a climate person, you know, haven't done the science, but I'm a believer in expertise. I'm a believer in the idea that has really led to the American miracle of the last century, which is we put great stock in expertise. We put great stock in science, and, you know, it led to the transformation of the American economic system. And so it's hard to set that aside for something like climate. In fact, you know, when essentially anyone who has looked at the issue without being funded by folks who have a vested stake in the outcome, has said, look, this is a compelling threat to our way of life. And how do you then look past that as you're doing things? So one of the things that motivated me going out was, look, I know I'm not a climate person. I know I don't know the science, but generalists, which is what the Foreign Service is largely made of, have the ability to not work the technical details, but at the big picture, how I, as the number two or the number one in the American embassy, you know, I had the ability to nudge things along by what my priorities were, where I put my attention. I knew that, or at least I hoped I'd be able to advance the process of American leadership on climate issues. Certainly that was the case under the Obama administration. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I faced the prospect of being the other side of things. You know, not that my role would be decisive in the path towards withdrawing from Paris, but I knew that I would be called on to take those incremental steps to disengage ourselves from that part of leadership. And I couldn't
see yourself doing that, right? What's the actual process by which one resigns from a position as chargé d'affaires of one of the most important American embassies in the world?
We don't have a year-to-year contract. I mean, we're a disciplined service, so essentially you either follow through the instructions you're given. I mean, there are other ways of avoiding it, but once you get to that level, that you have to make a decision. Can you implement the president's instructions? Can you implement the administration's policies? Or you have to resign the position. And so, I mean, there isn't...
No 2 weeks notice.
That's right. No. I mean, I think at that point, I left fairly quickly after the decision was made. I think that was better for all concerned, you know, that once you've left the position of that seniority, of that leadership, I mean, it's just not tenable to be there long term. So it was Friday evening, early Saturday morning that the issue came to a head, and I was out by Tuesday of the next week. And I think, frankly, the only reason I was there that long is because I'm doing some physical therapy for some leg problems I had while I was in China, and I needed to finish up not the program, but just to have one last meeting with my physical therapist so I could figure.
You had one last meeting with staff too, though. You had the town hall, and what day was that then?
That would have been
on the Monday, right?
On the Monday, right.
So why a town hall format, and what did you say there?
I mean, town hall format, one, I mean, it's sort of a personal thing.
Very.
That, you know, I've known these people in some cases for 20-something years, both the Americans and the Chinese staff. You know, they're Chinese staff who have been there 2 and 3 decades since the establishment, or in some cases before the establishment of diplomatic relations. And, you know, my career in China dates back to 1990 was my first assignment. So, you know, some of the people I have known since then, again, both the Americans and Chinese. So the idea of leaving without saying farewell was not very palatable. Also, at that point, your friend John Pomfret had picked up the story. The Chinese media had picked up the story. So I think disappearing would have been bad, both from the perspective of embassy morale. You know, if the leader, and I like to kid myself that people liked me well enough there, but also from the perspective of at the administration trying to have the head of a mission disappear sort of under the cloak of darkness could only have been bad for them. It would have encouraged people to think the worst. And one of the messages I gave to my staff was there are rumors, speculation out there. I asked them to not feed those reports. And I think to a large extent that was, in fact, given the size of more than 2,000 people on the China mission, I think it was remarkably disciplined. People were very circumspect. They were not feeding media speculation. I think if I had just left without talking to the staff, that wouldn't have been the case.
Right. And what then was the reaction of the staff? I mean, if you had to characterize it, they were generally supportive, disheartened?
People have been, I'm sure there are people out there who think I'm an idiot, who think I made the wrong choice. Uh-huh. They have been admirably
quiet.
quiet. The people who've been in touch with me both that day and subsequently have been very supportive. And, you know, said they expressed support for the decision. Both, and I tried to be clear when I talked to the embassy, look, it's a very personal decision on a lot of levels. One, my personal moral views about and other views about the decision, but also the personal situation I was in that allowed me to step away without, you know, look, my kids are out of college. My personal situation's a little different, which allowed me very forthrightly to make a decision that someone early in their career might not. And someone early in his or her career also has the ability to spend 20 or more years working to, I think, address will be some of the fallout from mm-hmm. the decision.
Did you hear from Tillerson, from Rex Tillerson, or from anyone else who is sort of more senior than you at State? And I haven't seen much comment from the State Department itself or from the White House on this.
I won't get into the sort of the private conversations I had. I will say that there was very nice comment from on the record public where they recognized that I was leaving and thanked me for a long.
That was all pretty boilerplate, right?
Yeah, but they didn't have to say it. They could have merely acknowledged my departure. I mean, I think it was I had great respect for the fact that they thanked me for a long career.
Okay. What about from Max Baucus, the ambassador under whom you served? Did you have any personal communication with him?
I've been in touch with both Max and his wife. I count myself as exceedingly fortunate to have worked with him. We had a great relationship when he was ambassador, and they both reached out to express concern I would say congratulations on the courage of my conviction. So.
Yeah. What about from your diplomatic counterparts in China? That's what I'm really curious about. I mean, if you could share this in any way, has anyone from the Chinese Foreign Ministry talked to you about this at a personal level?
I'm trying to think if I've ever had a personal conversation with someone from the Chinese Foreign Ministry.
Okay. What about more formally?
Subject. Yeah. I talked with my counterpart to let him know that I'd be leaving and to thank him for, I mean, I talk to him late at night on a Friday or Saturday evening more than I talk to my wife, at that time. So, we don't always agree, the U.S. government and the Chinese government, but we do have pretty highly functional working relations. So one of the calls I wanted to make sure I got done was to talk to my counterpart.
So there's a tradition of American presidents leaving personal notes for their successors. Terry Branstad has not yet taken up the post. That's why you were chargé d'affaires. He's going to be coming in the next month or so, right?
That's what I understand.
I think a lot of people reported very positively on once the note that George W. Bush left for Barack Obama came out. I mean, it was very gentlemanly and very positive and very encouraging, kind of a vestige of a bygone American gentility. But would you have left such a note for Branstad? Would you would you now leave sort of an oral note for him? What advice would you give to him on handling this situation and the myriad others that he's going to face once taking up the ambassadorship?
Wow. The advice I had for my staff, and it's a different direction, but it working in China, working in any high-level job, I think it requires the ability to take a deep breath and to realize, you know, which of the decisions in the course of a day or a week or a month will you remember in 10 years? I mean, there are probably a couple of decisions that affect the fate of the Republic. There are a couple that you might remember come the end of the year, and there are an awful lot that you just have to let wash over you. And a place as big and complicated as China, the ability where everyone thinks their decision falls into that first camp. In fact, probably most of them fall at best into the second and
mostly into that third.
Mostly into that third one. The other bit of advice I'd give, which I had a colleague I respect and who has spent a lot of time working in China gave me early on in my career, is just embrace the ignorance. You have to that you will feel at everything. You know, you wake up every day, and if it will be a rare day where you don't learn something that every Chinese understands as totally received wisdom, but just a revelation to you. And I think it's just something that's a cool thing about working in China. But you have to get past the idea that you can know everything because it's just too big, too complicated.
Absolutely. That's valuable advice to anyone embarking on a China-related career.
And I'm going to give them one last bit of advice.
All right.
Is there's a big team there in China, and they are dedicated to making Terry Branstad and making the United States succeed, whether it's under Donald Trump or Barack Obama. Or really anyone who sits in the Oval Office or who sits in the ambassador's office in China, that there is a team there who really, they know their stuff, and they are dedicated not only to their jobs, but to their country.
I have to ask, were there any murmurings about other people sort of resigning in solidarity with you on your staff?
It was gracious. They all allowed me to have the honor of doing it solo. No. No, that, you know, when I talked to the staff, one of the points I made was that there are some people, I mean, it made sense in my case. And, you know, I believed from a moral perspective that I needed to step down. But I just as firmly believe that it's honorable to stay on. It's honorable to continue to do the tough work day to day that we're going to need to do, not just because of withdrawal from Paris, but because of that's what the work of diplomacy is. It's, you know, the career public servants really don't get the breakthroughs. You know, those go to, and rightly go to, the political level of an administration who, you know, that will be the measure of their success or failure as an administration. But the hard work of sort of the day-to-day nuts and bolts of diplomacy, it's really tough, and it requires people who know their stuff, who are dedicated to it, to the task, to the United States, and to the commitment to nonpartisan service.
Before we turn our attention to sort of the China side of it, I want as a, maybe a way, a bridge to that topic. In November 2014, when we signed the first climate agreement with China, you were in Afghanistan, or you were doing Afghanistan-related stuff.
That's right.
Yeah. And you speak Dari, actually, right?
I speak really bad Dari. Really bad Dari.
That's out there in the press, though. But anyway, in the time since you assumed the position of deputy chief of mission there, you must have worked on climate issues with your Chinese counterparts, yeah, on implementation and things like that. There's one guy, I mean, Xie Zhenhua is probably the Chinese diplomat who is credited with driving the process the most from the Chinese side. Do you know him personally? Had you met him? And
I've met him a few times. You know, he was by the time those agreements were reached, he was, I think, phasing himself out, or anyway, in one way or another, being phased out of the leadership on that. And so I had not seen him probably since the fall of last year.
Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people have looked at your withdrawal and then thought about, I mean, and even before that, when as Trump was deliberating this, people sort of understood that it was going to be something of a gift to China to see the U.S. cede leadership on the climate issue to them. And they've probably, you know, quite happily, if not entirely sincerely, you sort of stepped very much into that space. Do you think that the withdrawal, first of all, did it do lasting damage to the U.S.-China trust on issues related to climate or on other things? Or does Beijing sort of understand that this is a Trump administration thing, not a U.S. thing, and that maybe it's offset by, and rather perversely, by the help that it gives to China in terms of optics?
Right. I mean, I'm not inclined to cut us slack for it being, I mean, you can't, I think it's not fair in a democracy to say that's a Trump administration decision. I mean, it's a United States decision. And I think the Chinese properly look at it as that. I think it leads them to, it would lead any country to take with a grain of salt anything the United States says, particularly something that was negotiated, that didn't have a congressional buy-in, that was a
executive order.
That's right. So, but that being said, I think they're happy to capitalize on the advantage it gives them to say they are leaders on climate without really having to raise the ante of what they'd already done,
right,
under the Paris Agreement. So,
I mean, so let's talk about that advantage. I mean, the optics are probably good. Is it mostly that? So the sort of soft power boost, the, you know, global popularity contest, the sort of the additional votes that it garners China? Or are there really specific economic benefits
that accrue to China? Again, I'm not a businessman, but I would think that my hunch is that in 50 years, we're going to be talking a lot more about renewable sources of energy as the dominant force in the global commercial and economic structures. And if we're not one of the major investors, if we're not one of the major players in that space, sure, I would think that leaving Paris will have concrete long-term commercial and economic impacts, and not good ones, on the United States.
To what extent do you think that we can make up for that through states and private enterprise initiatives like we've seen? Like we crossed paths with Governor Jerry Brown probably as you were on your way out. He was on his way into China in a very, very well-timed visit. And there are a number of state governors, oddly all Democrat state governors, who have also sort of signed on with him to state level diplomacy around climate. Do you think that that can sort of help to recover ground?
I think. Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be optimistic. I tell people I'm from Chicago. I'm a Cubs fan. I am an optimist,
by birth. Well,
so,
now you can claim you could be a little more, you know, have some beef.
I used to use that line when I was working Afghan issues, but the Cubs hadn't won the World Series at that point. So, of course. I mean, there are. Paris was not a panacea. The fact that we reached the agreement in Paris did not mean the climate issue was
solved,
fixed.
Right.
And the act of leaving Paris does not mean that all is doomed. I mean, it's still going to require a lot of work, and there are still other ways of doing it. But it was just an incremental, and not a small incremental, way of nudging things forward and of reasserting and reaffirming U.S. leadership.
So U.S. leadership is, I mean, there are a number of ways in which it seems to be ceding ground globally to China. First of all, while we are entering this phase of a repudiation of globalism, a sort of drawdown of our global commitments not to enter TPP, China is aggressively rolling out large sort of integrated diplomatic and economic initiatives, like, of course, the Belt and Road Initiative, which is, you know, Xi's signature thing. But also, you know, in years previous to this, now separate from Belt and Road, but the AIIB. And we can't necessarily say this is all, we can't put this entirely on Trump either. It was the Obama administration that was urging our allies not to join AIIB as founding partners, but that's gone ahead. I think there are a lot of people in the world right now who see America in retreat from its global commitments. Trump at NATO not invoking Article 5, chiding them for not paying their you know, for not increasing their spending to 2% of GDP. Is there a global leadership vacuum, and is China in any way suited to fill it?
I think China doesn't aspire to global leadership yet. And no. To the extent they do, it's a different vision of global leadership than at least I have. And I think 70 years of bipartisan consensus had. You know, the fact that there was consensus doesn't mean it is necessarily the right course. But if you look at where we were 70 years ago, if you look at where the world was 70 years ago, politically, militarily, economically, I mean, I think an objective look at the benefits that U.S. leadership has brought, it's a pretty positive outcome, not just for citizens of the world, but for citizens of the United States. You know, there are discontents with American leadership and with globalization and with the impacts of, the impact of commercial, you know, the global commercial order. To some extent, I wonder if that's more an issue of governance in the United States rather than of the absolute impact of globalization on the United States. I mean, the United States, from at a national level, is unquestionably more prosperous today than it was 20 years ago. It's also unquestionable that the benefits of that prosperity have not accrued to everyone. And so to me, that says it's an issue of how you, how you govern the impacts of globalization, both the positive and the negative within the borders of the United States. But that, like, that's getting a little beyond the scope of my,
maybe, doubly so for China. I mean, China is really sort of where the rubber has hit the road on globalization all along, right? It's the country that arguably has benefited most from it and has suffered its ravages pretty badly as well.
I mean, right. I mean, that's, I have to say, one of the disappointments on TPP was that if you look at the environmental standards built into TPP, it essentially, that and the Chinese vision of a low standard, global economic or commercial,
RCEP or whatever.
RCEP, right. I mean, the TPP essentially took the American environmental standards and made them an asset to the United States. In other words, having higher environmental standards built into a global trade accord, meant that not only would the environment improve globally or at least regionally, but the costs of environmental regulation that have been decried over the last several months and really for the last decades become advantages for American companies that are used to operating in that environment.
That's right. I mean, we can hope, I suppose, that China, just by having made so many verbal commitments now, and understood that it does need to put something behind its commitments to climate change and to slowing at least the ravages of ecological disaster, that it will also build these things into now some of the public goods that it's creating in the world. I mean, I'm hearing that AIIB has better environmental standards now that so many developed Western countries are part of it now, that China is really only primus inter pares among a lot of other countries that are involved in it. RCEP, I think Japan is also very much involved. Maybe they will sort of take a page from America's more stringent environmental demands that were baked into TPP. I mean, I think is there reason to think that might happen?
Sure. I mean, I've always been, there's an awful lot of reasons that China would have to upgrade both domestically but also internationally its environmental performance. I think the big one is just the domestic pressure, because of the realization within China of the negative impacts of a GDP, only looking at GDP as the measure of
GDP uber alles.
That's of growth. So,
yeah, I think when you look at what China had committed to in Paris, I mean, by 2030, I mean, reducing by, I think, 2/3 the energy intensity of every unit of GDP. I mean, that was a pretty bold commitment. And I just really, really hope that the U.S. withdrawal is going to encourage China to sort of step up rather than to say, well, now that I no longer have the U.S. sort of watching me and riding me, I'm going to slip in my own commitments. But
yeah, and I also, I mean, my take on our involvement in Paris is, look, a lot of times, I mean, it's not just on environmental issues, but the existence of outside pressure. I mean, the Japanese were used to this. They used that outside pressure, and the Chinese have done that, to go to their internal stakeholders and say, look, this isn't us, the Chinese system. These are our international commitments. Under Paris, we have to take these steps against industries that are in overcapacity, against steel and aluminum and cement and glass, the really energy-intensive, really dirty industries that China knows they have to take on. And I think they were looking to Paris, and they probably will look to Paris, but a Paris without the United States is a weaker agreement. I don't think anyone would contest that. It will be a weaker tool for those advocates, both of reducing overcapacity, but also of taking on climate.
Yeah, I think that there's this mistaken belief, people who don't really know China, that it's just a matter of the government fiat. If the party decides this, then that will happen. But China is too just bedeviled with all sorts of stakeholders who are at cross purposes with their environmental goals. They've got their major SOEs, and they may be state owned, but they certainly don't always obey what comes from on high, right?
Right.
You've talked a little bit about advice that you would leave to your State Department folks, the people who you left behind in Beijing. I mean, your service dates back, if I'm not mistaken, to 1990?
Is that 1990, right? That's right.
That's right. So, you have a real long perspective on the evolution of U.S. diplomacy. 1990 was before the first Gulf War. It was, you know, in a different moment. It was still sort of in the rosy glow of the Velvet Revolutions of 89. And at a time where it really looked like the end of history and the last man, the triumph of American style democratic capitalism worldwide. How has your view of the role of American Foreign Service changed across that period? And what sorts of advice would you give now to a young Foreign Service officer or would-be Foreign Service officer, like my intern Andy here sitting, is, you know, first year in an East Asia program at Georgetown right now?
Right. Maybe, Kaiser, I'll say this. When I started in 1990, I didn't have a cell phone. I didn't have email. I didn't have CNN to turn on. Maybe I had CNN, but it was really a nascent. I mean, the three things that drive not just the Foreign Service, but drive government in general now, which is the immediacy of news. It's something that happens, in a foreign country or in a remote location. It doesn't have the chance to percolate up. You don't have the opportunity to reflect, at a, first a local level and then maybe at the State Department level before it goes up to the White House for a response. I mean, really the immediacy of something happens and just my resignation is probably a perfect example that, you know, that was on headline news within hours of it happening. In fact, probably it would be hours before it happened, it was starting to get out. And it just changes, not only the sort of shift, the relative shift in American dominance that, you know, the before the first Gulf War, where we were on the verge of being the sort of unipolar world, mm-hmm. and we're really not there anymore, but also just the shift, of the balance of power from issues that were distinctly sort of Westphalian relations between states. To now, states are an important player.
There are all these non-state
actors.
Yeah,
I was at a conference before I left government. It was a track two. In other words, it was informal. Somehow they, you know, it was non-official, but it was, I had managed to get a pass and snuck myself in. And all of the issues they talked about were either subnational or supranational. They were issues of terrorism and how do you deal with citizens of your own country who are involved in terrorist activity, or things like cyber threats, infectious diseases. In other words, things that had a connection to nation states, but nation states were only one actor among many, many other competing forces. I mean, really, it's just a changed world.
Absolutely. And so for the young officer, the young would-be Foreign Service officer, I mean, I guess another question, and you are very much the embodiment of it, how do you separate your personal politics, your own personal convictions, whether they are ideological or from faith or what have you, from the service that you're obliged to render to your president?
Right. I mean, some of it is you have to know who you are. You have to understand what the sort of fundamental motivations, and that's allowed to evolve over a lifetime, I think. And part of it is understand what a public servant is, what role you play. You are not an elected official, but at the same time, I talked about expertise earlier in our conversation, and I think expertise is important. I worry that it's being devalued to some extent, in not just in the United States, but globally.
Yeah, it's a sort of global anti-intellectual wave, and revolution against the technocrats and whatnot. Yeah,
but I think there's value to understanding a place. There's value to understanding an issue, and that's what a public service. That's what civil servants bring to modern government. And I think it's important to understand the long-term perspective of everyone makes compromises in their lives, in their careers. There is a contribution to someone who knows he's going to be in place or she's going to be in place for 25 or 30 years.
Right.
My commitment is I can both live my values and serve a an administration or a president or a policy that I don't agree with, because there is the public face of that policy, but there's also the internal debate that will shape how the policy is implemented, few policies that I've seen are decided once and then never looked back on again. I mean, there is the ability to review, and I think both in the negative sense of do we ever end these battles, but also the positive sense of there are few policies that have ever been perfect the first time they've been rolled out, and that requires people who understand the pros and cons and who understand the background of the particular policy that's being implemented.
So what's next for you, Dave? What are you going to do now? I mean, you're in retirement. I mean, are you going to take up golf? Or I mean, certainly not, right? I mean, I just let the record state that Dave Rank is this very man of erect carriage and youthful demeanor. I mean, you look like you're in your 30s. Right.
I was a child bride, so like I said, okay. I've got my kids out of college. I'm a year away from having my kids out of college. I am in a very happy spot in my life where I look back 27 years of a job I genuinely loved. I loved not every day of it over those 27 years, but it was really a delight to go to work in the morning, whether it was in Washington or Beijing or Kabul. And I come out of that both with, I think, sort of an understanding of the world, but also sort of a babe in the woods. It is the only thing I've ever done in my life. I came out of grad school. I finished actually in Taiwan, a graduate program. And, in May, late May of 1989, early June, when I intended to come out and go into business with my freshly learned Chinese and find some business that was hiring in
not a good time
on the mainland, but it wasn't a great time. And so I ended up joining the Foreign Service. And for the first time in 27 years, I mean, the State Department, I talked about being a disciplined service, not only disciplined in you have to listen, you have to implement the policy of the current administration, but also it's just you don't run your life to a large extent.
Right.
So I am hopefully, late June of or mid-June of 2017, as I went through the retirement process at the State Department, one of the things they do is they go through they have a look at your annual leave balance. And I had the equivalent of having never taken leave for 3 years built up. So I have a little pent up vacation. I have relatives, brothers and sisters who I haven't seen. My sister I haven't seen in her place since she moved there almost 2 decades ago. So I have a commitment to get out to Utah to visit my sister. And what has been gratifying is a lot of people reaching out, not just to say, "Hey, Dave, we support what you did," but you know that the things have some value. And so it's kind of nice to, as I'm driving across the country with my bride, to think about what's next. And I haven't decided yet, but it's kind of exciting time to not know what I'm doing.
You're not done with public service, though. You may be done with the Foreign Service, but not with public service, certainly.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. It's hard to imagine having worked 27 years in one particular area to walk away entirely. But I don't know what that would look like.
Okay. Fair enough. So enjoy your pent up vacation, and then you drive cross country to Utah. Utah is lovely. So we were just talking about Utah on the drive up here about Arches and Bryce and Zion to get out there.
Yeah, my wife was able to pass through there. Was it last summer? I was working last summer. She was driving my daughter out to Los Angeles, and she said, "Oh, Dave, we gotta, when you have a little more time, we gotta pass through both of those, Arches and Bryce." So those are the stations, a couple of the stations of the cross this summer.
Anyway, wonderful. I mean, whatever you do, I'm sure you'll be a tremendous success in it. I think the world needs more men like you. What an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, and thanks for making the time and for inviting us into your home. Let's stick around and let's make a recommendation for our listeners. Yeah. So before we get to recommendations, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SUP China. Check out the app and subscribe to the newsletter at supchina.com. You can follow SUP China on Twitter at SUP China News and on Facebook at facebook.com/SUP China News. If you like the Seneca podcast, by all means, go leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes store or on Google Play or wherever it is that you go to review apps. This really helps and it means a lot to us. And make sure to check out our new Taishin Seneca Business Brief, our weekly podcast that we do in cooperation with China's leading business and finance magazine, Taishin. Now, on to recommendations. Dave, what do you have for us?
So, Kaiser, people who know me well know that I get most of my reading from the thrift store that I either I check them out online or from my local library, or I buy them at the thrift store. And the last time I was there, I picked up a copy of Thoreau's The Maine Woods, which I'm about a halfway through it, and my impression is, first of all, it is stunning to think that 200 years ago, or 170 years ago, when Thoreau was writing it, how much we have transformed this country, just the presence of the sort of Protestant work ethic and the industrial economy have transformed this country. But it also makes you think that Henry David Thoreau would have been a dreary traveling companion. I mean, he's a the dilettante's dilettante. He knows nothing about about woodsmanship, but he throws himself into the middle of things, up trying and failing to get up at least halfway through the book up Mount Katahdin, throws himself into the adventure, and he is a man who is not afraid of long sentences, of classical references, of obscure and a sort of circuitously worded sentences and paragraphs.
Is this a recommendation or is this warning me off of it?
It's a recommendation. I'm tempted after I finish reading him to read Hemingway or Peter Hessler with their choppy declarative sentences.
Right, right. Hessler is he somehow does that without being annoying. It's amazing.
Right.
Guy's just phenomenally gifted. I've got a book too to recommend. Mine, I've just started. It's actually not going to be out until this fall, but pre-order it if you can, because it's fantastic. It's called Little Soldiers. Little Soldiers, An American Boy, A Chinese School, and the Global Race to Achieve by Lenora Chu, or Lenora Zhu as it would be pronounced. Lenora is a friend of mine who lives in Shanghai. She's actually married to Rob Schmitz, who is the NPR the Marketplace correspondent in Shanghai, and also the author of an excellent book that we've talked about with him on this podcast before, an old friend of the show. Lenora is just let me just say this. She's a better writer than her husband. She's just a really, really crazily gifted writer. We've been sort of hooting in delight as I've been sort of translating on the fly, this book to my wife in Chinese, because there are these, wonderfully retold little anecdotes about her young son in this really hyper competitive Chinese kindergarten, where, you know, the teachers are just tyrannical. And of course, you know, she's like me. She came up with sort of a more tiger parenting, certainly, than I did. But even this makes that all pale in comparison. It's great. We plan to have her on the show, hopefully in tandem with somebody like Amy Chua, who wrote Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, who is actually on our company's advisory board. So hopefully that's going to work out. But Lenora's book is just terrific so far. I'm really, really enjoying it. Anyway, Dave Rank, thanks once again. And let me say one last time that I'm really proud to know you. I mean, my heart really swelled. And best of luck, and you won't need it, but best of luck anyway in all of your future endeavors.
Thank you, Kaiser. Great to be on the show. I have always been a fan.
I understand you have a daughter who's a fan.
I have a daughter who's a fan. If you will give her a shout out, you will make her week.
Okay, it's Maggie, right?
That's right.
Hey, Maggie. Hey, thanks for listening, and we really appreciate it. And also, God, your dad's awesome. All right, folks. The Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Thanks also to Anla Chang and Sarai Darabi from SubChina. Drop us an email at Seneca@SubChina.com. Visit our Facebook page at Facebook.com/SenecaPodcast and follow us on Twitter @SenecaPodcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.